Welcome, everybody. My name is Ray Arata, and I'm your host today. On behalf of Thriving Org, myself and Julian Burkest welcome you to the second in a series of three webinars featuring the Cars.com transformation journey. Today's call will focus on adopting and scaling, and with us today is the Cars.com discovery and delivery teams, as well as Cy Ahir and Mark Ferrara, who are the coaches. What we have planned today is going to be an interactive session with the team and possibly some interaction with some of your fellow participants. I'm going to ask the team to introduce themselves, and after they do that, I'm going to ask Mark to give us a brief overview of what we covered in the last call and to give some context for phase two of the transformation journey, at which point I'm going to turn it back to the team to share out some key insights and learnings from a before, during, and after perspective of this phase. So with that, welcome, and I'm going to turn it over to the Cars.com team. So over to you, Len.
Hey, this is Chris Thomas. I'm Scrum Master for CRM team and a Ready for Dealer team. Been here about a year. Started right at the launch of phase two.
Hi, my name is BJ Castro. I'm a product owner at Cars.com for SIY and pickup trucks team. Been working at Cars.com since January of last year and started right around the start of phase two, actually.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Nikitas. I'm an architect on our dealer-facing products. I've been working here about 3 years, and before the transition, I was a lead developer.
Bill Rabicki, senior manager of software development. I've been at the company for 10 years, somewhat collectively, and during the process, I was working on the dealer tools team as kind of the pseudo scrum master and kind of the architect on the team as well during the pilot program.
I'm the Clay Johnson, the director of product, and during phase two, I was playing product owner and developer and kind of scrum master representative or scrum master coach representative from the core team.
Will Hacker, I do user experience in our mobile web team, and during the pilot, I was with Bill and Nicholas on the dealer tools team.
My name is Len Lagasty, and I'm the manager of project management and methodology, and I was part of the Agile Core team, or the transformation team, throughout the entire transformation experience for Cars.com.
Thank you, Len. So, Mark, if you could you give us just a little summation of the framework and what we did in phase one, and then take us into the context of today.
Sure. Yep. Thanks, Ray. Again, I just want to thank all the good folks at Cars.com for joining us today and providing this opportunity to share their experiences with the broader community. And certainly thank Ray and Julian at Thriving Org for bringing us together. And my name is Mark Ferraro. I work with Redpoint, and I worked with Cy Ahir. And I work, we're the coaches from Redpoint. And what we did at Cars is we applied our three-phase transformation roadmap. And the roadmap is really somewhat unique in other, from other transformation programs. And the first, it's very much repeatable. The six-month roadmap, while every organization is going to be a little bit different, the patterns that we apply are very much so repeatable. It's time-boxed. We don't believe that transformation is something that should be spread out over multiple years. We believe that we can get in, we can be effective inside of 6 to 9 months, and then get out and leave the organization in a better place and then begin to thrive on their own. The other thing that makes our transformation approach somewhat unique is that we don't require any preparation on the part of the organization. In fact, we don't want organizations to do anything special or unique before we get there. We really want to see the organization as it is when we begin phase one. So with that, I'll step through very briefly an overview of the three phases. Last week, and we were able to go through some of the folks from the core team, and we really described our first phase, which is the context phase. And in this phase, it's usually time-boxed to about 4 weeks, and we're going after basically three key aspects that we're looking for out of phase one. The first thing we do is we assemble a core team, and that's really looking for representatives that represent the value stream from throughout the organization to really represent the stake of their constituent communities within the organization. So we want, you know, an architect to represent the architect perspective. We want some folks from the business to represent the business perspective. QA perspectives, and so forth. So we really use that core team to really talk about some of the aspects of things that aren't working, but ultimately to create a framework, which is the second aspect. So we want a core team. The next thing we want is a framework. And really what the framework is it's a very lightweight set of roles, activities, and work products that can really guide us through the transformation. Essentially, it's a vision of the 2B state, but it's only skeletal. It's very thin, just enough to get started. And then the last thing we go after in the context phase of phase one is a roadmap. We're really identifying some pilots and some activities that are going to take us through the 6 months of transformation. So coming out of phase one, we have a solid core team that's speaking as one voice. It's really taking ownership of a lightweight framework and a roadmap for how we're going to implement that framework. And it's really applying the roadmap and the framework that really goes after the new way of being or the transformation. That gets us to phase two, which is the focus of today. In phase two, there's two key things we're going after in phase two. First and foremost, we want to enact the pilot. So it's not enough to identify that framework, but now we're going to put it into practice. The unique thing about this is right now, as soon as 4 weeks into the transformation, we're going after real value-adding work. So at that point, we're starting to actually bring returns to the organization and really applying the framework on real projects to really exercise that skeletal framework and really put some muscle on it. So we start running the engine, we see where it needs some oil, we add some adjustments, we change it where we need to, and we run forward based on the experiences of the pilots. The next thing that we're looking for in phase two is really a sense of organizing around value. And we really want to look at how the organization has their folks sitting within the organization, and we really look at what are the things that are valuable to the customer, what are valuable to internal customers, and let's look at reorganizing around what's valuable to those folks. The key aspect, what we're looking for in phase two, is really the shift. We call it the shift. That's really where the organization is really starting to believe that this new way of being is something that's going to work for them. Right? At some point, hopefully we'll hear some of the good folks in cars talking to that in the next hour, really about how, they went from, the old waterfall processes or the old way of being really gets pushed aside, and people are wanting to go after the new way and really going after what's described within the framework. And then the last thing we'll cover next week is really phase three, and that's really keeping it whole in terms of the evolution phase. And what we do there is really set up and really establish the communities of practice and really making sure that oversight and governance is in place for those two aspects. So with that, I'll turn it back to Ray and good folks at PARS.
Thank you very much for that overview, Mark. It's actually sparked some new questions. So what I'd like to do to kick things off, you laid it out really well around right off the heels of taking ownership. It's all about enacting the pilot. So if you guys could, I'd love for somebody or a couple of you to speak to the key learnings and insights around and what came up for you around enacting this pilot. So whoever would like to start, please go ahead.
I can go ahead and start. So when I started in cars.com, phase two, like I said, was just starting, and I thankfully got to participate in one of the pilots. So for me, it was sort of a mishmash of learning Agile and then also learning cars.com. So it was actually pretty interesting. And right away, just participating in some of the teams, you start learning like the intricacies of Agile and users' needs and features. And I remember, taking Mark aside on some things and actually having maybe an hour or two talk to try and understand, these users' needs and features and how people were starting to sort of, work through the Agile process, and actually people actually started at the feature level and coming up with just different ideas of what we can do on this particular project and just really brainstorming that way. And what we end up doing is sort of just getting all that out and then start theming them and going backwards to understand that these features are actually supplying these needs, to these particular users. So you end up sort of prioritizing the important needs that you need to start attacking to sort of really execute and provide value for this project. And that was sort of a different way of thinking, compared to old waterfall processes and to other places where I've worked, quite honestly, where it's like people had these ideas and they had great ideas, but without sort of focusing on users and needs, you can end up putting out features there that may not be as valuable as maybe some other features might be.
Hey, this is Bill, and I was what we call a delivery manager, which is kind of like an engineering manager a little bit at other companies, at the time when we were getting around to starting up an Agile pilot program. And during the time, I had a staff that was kind of segmented into some that were dedicated to these long waterfall projects, and then we had other people that weren't assigned to the projects that were working more on maintenance, more like a ticketing system. And we just got a new person that was going to end up being the product owner for one of our products. And when I was talking to him, we both decided we had no interest in really doing another giant waterfall project. So we took the additional developers that we had, and we really just started taking all those tickets that were sitting in a queue somewhere and theming them up into what could be logical releases that could deliver value. And getting those developers really on board with the process and working through writing out stories and writing out tasks and things like that. And we did that. We started our preparation work probably about a month or two before we actually started working in a full Agile fashion. But as soon as we caught up to it, we had a backlog of things to do for the remainder of the year with these people. And I mean, I don't think it's a stretch to say that by the time the people on the waterfall teams got a glimpse or two of the sprints that we were doing and the releases we were doing, they didn't want to be on those big waterfall projects anymore. So it really kind of helped organically get people interested and excited to sign up for this. And then the only problem was just keeping the resources dedicated and getting the support to keep the team moving forward with the Agile framework rather than the waterfall framework.
And this is Nick, the architect, and I was on. I was actually that one of those resources on Bill's team that was stuck on a waterfall project while the rest of the team got to work on the Agile one. And I had been coming off of earlier in my career a lot of Agile projects, came to the organization and found exactly why it's so difficult to build web apps on a waterfall process given the speed of the industry. And I was kind of in a state of high frustration, and I had been waiting for this Agile transformation for about a year. I got to see how we'd suffer. I got to see how the Agile team was cranking things out, getting things done, and moving forward. And I was quite jealous at that point and eager to move over. So I think the interesting thing about having two projects side by side, one waterfall and the other Agile, is you could really compare the experience and the morale that the two different teams were experiencing.
We really did that to screw with Nick.
Anybody else have anything to add there?
Yeah, this is Will. One of the larger challenges in going through the transition was for the UX team really getting our mind around the Agile process and how it deconstructs everything to the smallest component. And a lot of the tools we use in user experience are things like high-fidelity mock-ups, wireframes, pixel-perfect design. That doesn't work when you're doing sprints. So you end up having to learn new techniques. A lot of activity in the industry now is looking at what they call lean UX, and it's using tools like prototyping and sketching.
And I mean, so Will and me, Bill, worked together on that as kind of members of the core team initially. And before that, I don't think there was ever a project you and I worked on where your work was directly handed to me and we talked about it. It was always hey, Will created this artifact 2 months ago, and now we're finally evaluating if it fits into the rest of the business requirements doc. And by that time, the conversation would have grown out of control, where now it's a matter of minutes or a couple meetings to figure out, yep, we're on the right track and we can break this stuff down into tasks, stories, and deliverables.
Yeah, waterfall is really more of an assembly line where you do your work, you put it on the conveyor belt, and push it down to the next person.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys have any recommendations for the participants who might be wondering, how did you make this transition from Agile into this learning these new things? We did talk about this a little bit on Monday, and you guys had a lot to say around what I refer to as mantras. What might be some suggestions you might make for how to head into enacting these pilots in this new way of thinking?
Do it fast. Don't try to slowly step into the process, because it just hurts so bad when you do that, if you're straddling two different software development life cycles. And then the second thing is really just getting people out there and making them uncomfortable at first and coaching them that you got to ask the silly question if you don't know why you're writing all your stories on an index card and taping them to a wall, if that's how you decide you want to go about doing it. And just getting people out there and really exploring it, because the faster they become comfortable with it, the faster they take ownership of it, and it's a whole different experience versus looking at a Microsoft PowerPoint project presentation versus actually owning a Scrum board.
Yeah, one of the major things as kind of a rep on one of the dealer tools, my dealer center projects, was really flipping them from one day and half the team looking at a giant Word doc of bullet points to the next day telling them, tell me what you're going to do. And it was really just a complete flip of the empowerment from the top to the bottom. And it was very disorienting to people, because everybody was constantly kind of looking for someone to tell them what to do, and you have to walk them through it, but never take advantage of the situation and fall into, as a representative, telling them what to do. You always want to talk them through the thinking of what they should do so that they flip that mindset. And I think that was very important, because once they realized they were empowered, they started running on their own. And you could see shifts where, the people in the waterfall world were waiting to be told. The people just getting into the pilots were kind of looking to be told and, sort of starting that thinking. And then the people who kind of got it faster, and as you saw kind of the people take off, they came back and told you what they did and said, what'd you think of that, It was very quick in that thing. It's very, very hard. It's like teaching a kid to ride a bike. You got to let go of the seat, let them fall a couple times. But, that pain is going to help them figure it out faster, how to stay up.
Well, and this is Chris, the Scrum Master, and I think it's also building that awareness that it's okay to fall off the bike. It's okay to stumble, because that's why we're time boxing. In another 2 weeks, we'll pick ourselves up and get right back on and keep moving forward.
Yeah, and I think we brought this up in the last one, too, when we were talking, is, you're really talking about 2 weeks to figure out if you're right or wrong, if you're on the mark or not. With the waterfall project, I mean, you could sacrifice 4, 6, 8 weeks easily just to figure out if the two teams in the assembly line are in agreement on one work product, and no code's been written, no value's been delivered to the organization.
And this is really where the beauty of having a very minimal framework coming out of phase one helps. So now the team is actually just learning the skeletal nature of the framework and just the easy steps to get through it, or a few of the steps to get through it, and then they're building it on their own. They're figuring this stuff out as they go.
Well, and that changes from team to team, and that's the beauty of the framework, not a process, that as long as teams work within the framework, how each team works, that could differ across the whole org.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to mention that it's funny that, this is sort of bringing up, how things went previously. Like, definitely ask as many questions as possible, but then also have sort of the patience to learn and understand and sort of leverage people that have been in Agile before or sort of more seasoned in it. Because I remember asking questions, and all of a sudden I was asking questions, and then they were answering those questions with more questions. And it was sort of what Clay had talked about before. It was like you sort of have to get people to learn on their own how Agile works and what exactly is a feature, what exactly is an epic, what does framework even mean. And I just remember going through that process of just trying to figure that out to sort of put out these work products. And it was, it was fun and frustrating at the same time.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to throw in, kind of a little bit off Chris's comment, was I had mentioned before I had teams that were on the waterfall projects and teams that were not staffed to that, more in maintenance. And the people that were on the waterfall projects were the people that had been there longer or more seasoned. And then we had the people that were newer to the team that were kind of in the other bucket, because nobody would step up and assign work to them. Well, now you put a whole bunch of tasks in front of them and people step up and say, I can do that today. And you're going to find out resources are more capable of doing things than you might have given them credit for. And we saw a lot of that early on with the teams and people seeing other people having success and really rising to meet the challenge, because nobody wants to turn to their buddy and say, I'm the reason why this release isn't going live, because I couldn't figure out this story.
We have a question from one of the participants. Julian, if you could mic Greg Olson, he's got a question.
Yes, the question I had is, with the UX team, are you actually able to perform usability testing then, and how does that work in such a rapid environment?
So the way we would do this as well again, the way we do UX is we build lightweight prototypes using tools like iRise or Axure, and we do what we call guerrilla testing, which is we'll literally go into a Starbucks, and we'll literally put something on the person's, whether it's a mobile device or a laptop computer, and we'll be able to do very quick tests of small parts of the features. And then we also do have an in-house lab where we do more formal studies.
Yeah, and the delivery side of things where you're actually developing code really hammered into a time box very quickly, right? You have sprints, so 2 weeks, you do this. And we had some mitigating kind of processes in there to flip from waterfall to, you know, Scrum. But the discovery side we kind of left open and left that some of that pain of not time boxing happen, because you have a non-time box process where people are working and it's done when I think it's done instead of it's done when we hit the end of the wall. And that would slam up to that wall, and we've learned over through those phases about doing discovery and the phases ahead of it that, you know, having that cadence, so not only do we have a lab, but we have explicitly twice a week, every week, someone's in there booking time with users, and it's ready to go. And we have not had a time when no one had anything ready to show. We have times where people are getting backlogged wanting to get into that room. So the cadence and having something to say, you know, next week on Thursday, that's your spot, and if you miss it, you're out, has actually helped time box that upfront understanding of what we need to do, and that helps keep the UX lean, like Will was talking about before.
Yeah, and one thing you'll notice, because of the way UX designers tend to work, it takes a little while to sort of build up a runway of projects. So if you first switch over to Agile, you might notice that the dev team doesn't have a lot to work on right away. That will change over 6 months.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you. Just a little reminder to our participants, because some of you joined late. If you have a question, because this is an interactive session, press 1 on your keypad, unless you have a real burning question, and press 4, and I'll keep an eye on it. So what I'd next like to ask someone from the CARS team to speak to is, Mark talked about the other thing that you guys really look to see happen is this organizing around values. If somebody could speak to what that brought up and the challenges and opportunities and what showed up in your transformation, that would be a great way to start.
Initially in the pilot projects, the phase two stuff, we kind of took everything that had already been sitting around, some of the existing projects, and we started flipping them into, okay, what are the ones that we can craft into Scrum, clearly, though there's a requirements document. And, you know, if people, the first point of that where you kind of hit that value of should we do this or not do this, you had the team sit down with a giant requirements document and just start throwing the bullet point requirements out that didn't matter to them. Right? They were like, we need to build this thing, and we kind of, this doesn't matter. It provided no value to the team, and they couldn't figure out why it was even documented. It was just noise in the system. What was other great is you had that stuff come in, you story pointed it, you got stories built out, and then you had the product owner come back with the team and kind of reorganize everything that came in. So where you had a top-down kind of requirements doc, you flipped it to stories, we got rid of a bunch of stuff, and then you even refactored that to see if it made any sense. And really the focus early on, we pushed it hard, was get to market. Any day that you're not getting to market, you're not delivering quote-unquote value. So the easiest way to say was get it done faster. We did month and 2 month kind of releases, which were much faster than the 9 months that we were kind of used to.
Hey, Ray, this is Mark. One of the things I would add is, you know, really clarifying that when we say we really want to organize around value, not values. Values are certainly very important, and part of all the decision-making process is based on a core set of values. But really what we look for in phase two is organizing around value. Now, we actually took a bit of a course correction. You know, the framework is somewhat flexible in that the way things were lining up at CARS, actually the reorganizing around value, we call it a reproductization, or really setting up the product teams themselves, was something that actually was shifted into phase three, and something we'll probably talk a little bit more about next week. And then we actually pulled the Kenya practice content from phase three, and we started working on that a little bit more in phase two. So apologies for not calling that out sooner.
Thank you, Mark. I wrote down values. Maybe I heard value and put something else in there, so thanks for cleaning that up. So somebody else was going to speak to this piece from CARS. Who would like to go next?
Yeah, this is Len, and I just wanted to make the comment that it was during kind of phase two we started thinking about having dedicated product teams. So we actually shifted from a project mentality, and we're almost coming up on our one-year birthday on May 9th, where we actually stopped all of our existing projects and relaunched as products. And those products were aligned around a value. You know, so each product had specific KPIs that they were actually going to start working towards. And so it was an actual restructuring and a rethinking of how we actually did business towards the end of phase two.
This is Chris, and taking it down to, you know, the team level, what's nice about Agile, Scrum, the product backlog, is just how it's tied to the time boxing, where the product owner has a list of things that he or she wants to get done. Well, we only have this much time to get something done. What's more important? We have the list in front of us, and they can move things around and really see the roadmap as a whole of what do we want to get done first. What's more valuable to get out the door? What can wait?
This is Nick in the architecture team, and one of the things that I found was it was easier for the product manager to determine what's the most valuable features and what he really wants when he'd see just, you know, he was co-located with us. You know, we started working together more than we ever had before and having a lot of conversations. So he'd get a lot more exposure to the development cycle and what we were doing and what kind of challenges we had. So he was more likely to know exactly what our limitations were, what our capabilities were, and why exactly projects would take as long as they did. And he was less likely to just get greedy and want everything and just try to ram it into the schedule and hope there's some way we can absorb it. Because when you saw how we worked and you saw what we were doing and saw the risks of overstacking a project, they'd be less likely to, they'd be more understanding and more reasonable on, you know, how software can be developed.
This is BJ. I wanted to piggyback on that a little bit. So, you know, with Agile and the core teams, it really emphasizes, like, a collaborative type effort to understand, you know, the valuable, the usable, and the feasible portions of this product, and then try and come up with something that, you know, it's minimal viable product and then eventually something that's minimal marketable feature, right? So, you know, the product owner has ownership, I guess, of the success of the feature, you know, but it really is, I want to emphasize, a collaborative effort between understanding what the lead architect is trying to say and what your interaction designer is trying to say, and trying to come up with those exact feature or the minimal viable product where you can put out something that has value and the delivery team can work on and really believe in, you know, and sort of make the whole product a success.
And I think it's really kind of that shared ownership and the success of the product that made the difference, because before, under the kind of the waterfall structure that we had, people were used to throwing things over the wall. The business could ask for as much as they wanted, and it was up to the developers then to build it in time and on budget, and if we missed our deadline or didn't get it all finished, it was our problem. It wasn't kind of a whole team problem. And, you know, we even found a lot of the inner team animosity that we were suffering before with, like, developers would want to push out as many features as they could. Testers were scared to let bugs out, so they'd, you know, the developers would push the gas, the testers would push the brakes, and we'd end up fighting. Since it was a whole team that's all kind of working together, co-located, we're used to each other, we know everyone on a personal level now where we didn't before, people are more likely to figure out what they have to do to make the product work. And that was a fundamental shift, rather than throw it over the wall and then point fingers when something goes wrong.
You just said the magic word, shift. I'd love for you guys to point towards when you recognized the shift and what that was like, and if you could, any additional comments, because Mark mentioned earlier that's when the people who come from the waterfall side of things start to believe. So if you guys could speak to that, that would be great.
Yeah, this is Will again. And one of the things that I noticed when you sort of felt the shift was really happening was when everybody was taking responsibility for the success of the release. So it wasn't sort of the old way of saying, well, I'm done now, it's the QA guy's problem. Now it's all of our problems. You eventually get to the point where you have a visual designer maybe helping do UAT testing. That wouldn't have happened in the past. And all of a sudden you just started seeing this kind of daily collaboration. And it's really, the co-location can't be oversold. It's a great concept, and it really helps.
Yep. I think one of the pivots I saw was the fact that, you know, there was a conversation early on in Phase 2 where developers would talk to other developers or product owners or whoever would say, oh, you got an Agile project, haha, good luck with that thing, even though they all kind of were infuriated by the current process. And then quickly, probably after the Wave 2 of pilots kicked off and we started kind of celebrating up the successes of what the pilots had done, everybody who had said, haha, you're on an Agile project now said, how the hell do I get on that Agile project, right? And kind of flip it over. We were still using the term project, obviously, and kind of pivoting over. The other thing I think piggybacking off of Will's thing was the user acceptance testing as an example. Not only was everybody pitching in, but they were doing it before we would schedule these 2 weeks of user acceptance testing. And nothing would happen during those 2 weeks except user testing. And we'd usually just eat away at those dates anyway, because we would be slipping dates everywhere. What was happening now was everybody was using it kind of every day and user acceptance testing it along the way as we did it, and they kind of accidentally figured out how to do testing in Agile, which is always a challenge.
Yeah, you're really working with your dev team really every day, and sometimes you're actually, there's a phrase you'll hear, designing in the browser, and it's where you're actually sitting there looking at the code or looking at the, you know, the app in a browser and being able to say, hey, move that up, move that down, change this, without having to write a bunch of project artifacts.
Well, I was just going to say, so that went along, too, with the QA testers, too, about the QA testers and the developers building a tighter relationship.
Yeah.
That the tester didn't have to wait until that development was 100% complete, where, no, you're sitting next to the tester, developer, you know, developer would say, hey, I got this chunk of code you can test. Don't test anything else. Tester would test that, look okay, not look okay. They'd be able to yell over the wall, hey, fix this, or it's good, keep going, and just building a tighter relationship within that team.
Yeah.
Before I call on a participant, I'm wondering, Mark, if you have any comments to add in here on this thread.
One of the things, I guess I would want to reach out to Clay to maybe elaborate a little bit more. He had described the success of the pilots. You know, if you can elaborate, or if any in the room can elaborate, to potentially even some of the bottom line successes of the pilots. You know, how was this really affecting the organization in terms of business results?
Yeah, the pilots were set up in three waves. Just a little background, and actually they were kind of custom crafted in order of kind of who had kind of the people that could do it, and you know, were really set up by the core team to hopefully do successes that we could then celebrate. And what we saw was we had a very long release cycle, but we had projects that went out very quickly in wave one and two that actually really did move the bottom line. There was a little faith here. We tried to do it. We did quick tests. We had, you know, key metrics that we measure every day move 5 to 10% right out of the gate, 1 month after starting work on the effort. We had MDC, our MDC platform, our dealer tool platform, you know, really had huge incremental, like, performance gains. And not only did we see performance gains, but we also saw the flip side. We had, you know, massive drops in support call volume, massive drops in, so it really, our modules in our world really affected, you know, had positive effects around the organization, and the core team really kind of tried to trumpet that as well, that it wasn't just within our little globe we were going to be affecting, we were going to affect the whole kit and caboodle.
Yeah, and I think to that, to speak, when we got a product owner, and we started realizing what teams are really adjacent to our teams, who really are the consumers of our services and who's going to be affected by our changes, we were able to identify like a couple small internal changes we could make to reduce the support costs. These were things that weren't going to get picked up on a major project initiative that was going to come down the pipeline, but they were things that are of really high value. And we executed, I think it was two sprints, basically, to install some very simple functionality for our support crew to help support our dealerships. And then just a few months after that, reports started coming out in like these 70 to 80% drops in turnaround time to resolve some of these issues. And it's like, yep, no one person has all the answers here. We really got to reach out and open up the gates as far as who can supply value.
Yeah, and it wasn't necessarily the people picking the projects were doing a much better job or anything like that, but what we did see was the people picking the work, the teams picking the work, were really picking off things that they could do and would provide value. And before we switched, like I was part of the project picking path, whatever the hell it was that we listed projects out, for 2 years before this, and basically the question was always, what can we do? Which ones of these can we do? And what you saw from the pilot teams kind of when they started flipping over, the decision was what should we do? And they came up with reasons why we should do A over B. Mm-hmm. And then by executing on that should decision-making up front quickly, we saw those gains that materialized in improved business metrics.
I think some of the gains we also experienced were just because when developers got moved off of, you know, project tasking, like, you're on this project and you're going to change this application. They didn't really have ownership in that application. It wasn't theirs. They didn't have to maintain it or stick with it, you know, after it was completed. And after the Agile transformation, since they were on a project team that belonged to them, they all wanted to do the best they could. One, because they know they'd be maintaining it, but also because it was their product. They wanted to make an impact on it. They wanted to change it, rather than, you know, being almost temporarily assigned to do some unit of work.
There's a question from Greg.
Thanks again, guys, for both the seminar and taking the questions. The question I had is again related to this sort of UX dev relationship. Then who owns the overall user experience? One of the challenges we have is that our user is, in essence, not necessarily anyone that fits the profile of either the UX members or the dev team. We have a geriatric audience, for instance, in one area. So it's very difficult for us to be fast, to decide upon an MVP, and yet I can hear the advantages of doing that. So how do you guys own the overall user experience without becoming segmented in doing just features?
Yeah, this is Will. One of the key things we do is within each individual product team, there's sort of the UX lead who owns the UX for that function, but then the UX team is constantly getting together, trading ideas, making sure that what I'm doing in one app is okay with another app. So it's a lot of sort of lateral communication. So while there's a lot of collaboration going on within the product team itself, you're also going out, meeting with your peers, and talking about, you know, what we're all doing in this area.
Do we dare hint at communities?
Yeah, I mean, that's where the communities of practice actually help moving up into phase two, which is, you know, who are the practitioners, what are the practices they're doing, and what should they share across each other, either process they're doing, actual work products they're creating, and how does it share across that? It was consistently positive experience. You know, rocky when you get started, but the user experience community has been pretty strong about that. The developer community has been very strong about that. I mean, things that development managers were trying to kind of push down around unit testing and code quality or whatever, you know, and it was always kind of a push-pull, you know, top-down thing, have actually flourished under kind of this community effort where here's value that you can provide through these things, and we have teams actually developing unit testing, developing the work, and there's also an ability to do it because some of the time is actually dedicated per each sprint to do activities like that.
Yeah, and one of the advantages of all the increased testing is you're talking to your end users, whether they're consumers or your dealer customers. So you're talking to them much more often, so you can think about the user experience with confidence that, you know, what I'm doing makes sense and resonates with people.
Yeah, smaller, more incremental changes of higher value rather
yes.
than...
Yeah. Could someone define what a community of practice is for some of the people on the call?
Yeah, this is Len. And so what we did is we set up a role-based community. So we had these new dedicated teams on products. So we pulled all the roles together on all the teams around what they are practicing. So it wasn't people who were just interested in development or interested in testing. They were actually practicing within the framework. And what that allows us to do is actually share, as Clay was mentioning, share the best practices and share information that would be useful to across all of the teams. So individual teams just weren't operating in silos and building their own little world and building their own practices. There was still this broader community. It's almost like their home base that they can kind of go back to and share what they're actually practicing back on their teams.
Yeah, you can imagine it, like if you know about user groups, so you have like a Linux user group or whatever, it's a community of practice within the actual, the physical community of, say, Chicago. This is almost like user groups within the organization that are sharing practices. And what's interesting about that is you may have a user group or a community of practice for user experience and a community of practice for testing, and then those two communities will actually get together and talk about their touch points. How do we test the user experience? How do we get tests worked back into the user experience to improve what we're seeing coming out of testing.
And then out of that, all this information would flow back down to the individual product teams.
Yeah. Right. Perfect, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the things we try to do in the UX team is when we're doing our in-house lab testing is we try to get the devs there or the team architects there so they can actually see this end user's pain points and sort of really understand that consumer and their needs.
Thank you. So, what I'm visualizing here is, the shift has occurred. People are starting to leave waterfall behind and really kind of embrace the new framework. They're adopting things, and you guys are really starting to move forward. Can someone speak to some of the side-to-side conversations that you're speaking to and how this sets the stage for the community of practice that becomes more prevalent in stage three? We talked a little bit about that on Monday.
So I think that some of the major themes that are coming up, so this is Bill, and I now a manager on the development side. So some of the major themes that exist out there, like how much coding standards do we need in order to really be functional? What do we want to do for code reviews? What new practices do we want to try, like peer or pair programming? Those are all kinds of things that, can get kicked into the community of practice. What we're trying to get to is getting, the managers of those individuals to really sponsor those communities and raise up, hey, these are the points of quality that I would like to see come out of the topics I'd like to be addressed, but not say specifically, I need you to go do this or that. Come up with a way to go meet these metrics and show me how, you guys as leads are really coming back to your product teams with ways to raise the bar and set higher expectations. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Does somebody else have something to add? Maybe Mark or another one of the people on the team?
Sure. Hey, one of the things I would add, just to bring the context back to the framework, is it really is the communities then in phase three that take ownership of the framework. And it's through these conversations and really evolving your standards and really evolving the practice and guidance around all these pieces that gets anchored then back into the framework. So the communities of practice are, while the products are very much focused on getting product out the door and delivering value to the customer, the communities are really all about really evolving their backlog towards how can they work more effectively as given practitioners within the organization.
Yeah, as those practitioners are moving along, there's kind of like a hierarchy, obviously, employee manager, manager of managers, and manager of manager of managers. As you see these things kind of, uncomfortability introduces itself, obviously, throughout this whole process. And that uncomfortability, it breaks down the communication up and down and drives that peer-to-peer communication with the constant movement. You don't have time to just wait for your manager to email you back, You have more of that situation. As you get practitioners sharing across the aisles, if you will, information, that the manager's role removes itself from kind of that, answering questions and dictating practices to more of a kind of a coaching mentality. Mm-hmm. And the manager's shift moves away from, discipline and implementing process, but more toward, setting goals, setting personal development goals, team development goals, community development goals, and really how to highlight and improve the success of those individuals. Without that, you're really hoping that there's a tribe that will all think alike, and you have to have that kind of coach leader that while the team is on the court, they're executing, in basketball, they're executing independently based upon the practices that have been taught to them, but you still have timeouts, you still have these issues where you come over and the manager's stepping away from it, looking at it from an above view, can give more context into the people that are deep in the weeds.
Right. And I think just the go into that a little bit further. You know, I think it's part of what we or what we're trying to pursue here is separating out the idea of management from leadership, because they're really two different things. The developers fundamentally don't need a manager. The organization needs a manager to hold people accountable, write reviews, and do things like that that all HR requires. But the leadership really doesn't require the position. The leadership can come from anywhere, and the communities of practice are a great place to look for that, and not just saying the manager is going to supply all the leadership to the team. So let it happen a bit more organically, and let the manager do more coaching to other teams to say, hey, we've seen these other pieces of leadership come up organically elsewhere in the organization. Have you guys thought about trying to adopt these? What's preventing you from doing it? What impediments can I move? And how do we get the ball rolling on some of these things?
Yeah. So a question on manager or coach. Is the manager becoming obsolescent? Is this a hybrid model of coach and manager? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we don't have a formal role in the framework, a role. There's still a position of manager here. If you were to visualize the team as a circle, we want the manager to be kind of bumped up against the circle, but not in the circle. So what this allows them to do is bring that perspective outside of what the team is doing. They're really bringing that perspective of how they're actually doing it. So as Bill mentioned, they're really there to kind of coach the team on how they're actually fulfilling their role within the framework.
And you also got to think that, so these teams are coming up, you know, semi-independently with their own roadmaps and their own technical visions of how they want to go build their product set. But what we don't have inside the core team is anybody that's looking at staffing or resourcing that can be brought on board. Those are points that I think can still be communicated through an engineering manager, and then we can have a decision about priorities and where we should start, you know, moving the army to best align to the vision of the company and the KPIs that we want to go, or the metrics we want to go hit to prove that we're showing success and value.
Yeah, I think the engineering manager probably has the largest shift moving into Agile, because they're no longer telling people what to do and when to get it done. They move into more of a supportive role of, you know, I'm a manager of the Java developers. I'm going to make each of my people the best Java developer that they can be. Mm-hmm. I'll get them training. Okay, and this team needs more Java developers. I'll figure out how to get them that. So it's more of kind of a less hands-on, but more of growing those individuals within the teams.
And one of the things that I found that the managers have been doing increasingly is being tasked more with removing organizational impediments, for one, and also observing the overall health of their teams and the strength of their practice. So the engineering managers now, instead of telling each developer what they should be doing and tasking out their day, they're looking at the health. They can step back from the day-to-day distractions and look at the overall health and strategy of the organization. What skill sets do I need to build? You know, what do I need to improve on? Where am I weak? And make those kind of decisions. So it moves them up to kind of a higher strategic level. So it's not so much that the manager's been lost responsibility or focus or control. They're really able now to concentrate on the things that are important.
Thank you. Are there any burning questions by the participants?
Guys, this is Mark. I would like to hear again yesterday when we talked about how the one testing team or the one support team was able to remove a bottleneck in the testing function, and how that had some very significant results to the organization. If you could share that story, I think that would be valuable to the participants.
I think the one thing we talked about was just with one of my teams, in the beginning, it was the QA, the testers, just waiting until development is completely done. And then they'll test. Meanwhile, development's moving on to something else. Testers find bugs. They got to throw it back into development. And meanwhile, I mean, that starts derailing the whole time boxing and timeline. So what happened is I started integrating those testers with development. And again, you know, co-location is a huge success doing this. And building that relationship between that trust between developers and testers that, hey, my development's not completely done, but you can test this portion of it. So please, testers, don't, you know, tell me the stuff that doesn't work that I just told you doesn't work. And it took a little while, but I mean, it just took off where now we can complete a sprint where we're no longer developing till the end of the sprint. It's developing just constantly with testing, and you know, there's no queue for testing at the end.
Yeah, a lot of it is we've shifted individual blame when something goes wrong to now kind of a team responsibility for quality. So I think it's a different mindset now where the entire team should be thinking about the quality of the application versus just an individual making sure it's okay before it goes out to production.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it was the realignment of goals, because previously, you know, when the developers would finish something and throw it over to the wall of the testers, the testers needed a lot of time just to figure out and understand what we built and how it was supposed to work. So it would take them a lot of time just to kind of get their bearings and figure out what was going on. And then they always had the fear of, I can't let any bugs go to production. I'm going to be in a lot of trouble. So the testers would be very, very careful about letting anything go through, and the developers would be wanting things to move on. And, you know, when the testers and developers were pulled into the same team with the same goals of delivering a quality product on time and getting it out the door, they were working together so closely the whole time that the testers, by the time they got to the end of the sprint, would feel pretty comfortable with the work product, with the level of quality since they had been testing throughout the process, that they felt empowered to say, yes, this can go through, and if there's any bugs, at least we can address them quickly instead of having to wait another month for the next release to go out.
We also saved a lot of overhead by stopping the QA testers from officially reporting every bug and defect, since they're sitting next to their developer partner, team member. Hey, this doesn't work. Can you fix it? Okay, it's fixed. Test it again. Thanks. Move on.
Hey, Ray, I had a question before we wrap up here.
Sure.
The question that I have is for people who are in organizations where they don't have buy-in to do this globally, to how they could do that in their current team or on a smaller scale.
Well, this is Chris Thomas. What you can do is, you know, not that I would ever hide anything from my boss or upper management, but what teams can do is they can have the waterfall appearance to outside the team, but within that, I mean, it's basically following that framework of we have a list of work to do, development, task, break it down for themselves, work within a time box, you know, have a daily scrum, call it a status meeting to make upper management happy, but you can, you know, still have that outside waterfall image, but underneath that, the team itself can, you know, work within their agile framework.
Yeah, I mean, essentially a Gantt chart is very similar to this, even though I hate the term Gantt chart. But I mean, if you're breaking those tasks down, what you're getting is really kind of stories and tasks, and you're estimating the hours. But the problem is you're doing it all way too detailed, way too far out.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's any way to, maybe you do that, you kind of implement a situation where you revisit the Gantt chart every 2 weeks and constantly update the end dates, you might actually see your end dates move closer to where you are now instead of farther where you are now. I mean, we've seen this personally work with a complete multiple database Oracle upgrade where we had to migrate data back and forth across boxes. That was an 8-month project, 9-month project with about 32 people on it. We've seen it work in operational support here where we have operations people integrating into our product teams and kind of leveraging some of our practices, but not all of them, into a fairly large organization here, and actually integrating all the way through the customer service to the end user back into us and getting communications back and forth.
Julian, this is Mark. One of the things I'll just call out, just to add on to that, is really just emphasizing exactly what these gentlemen are saying. But really the 6-month roadmap that we apply really is a fractal. The same pattern that we apply at CARS can be applied at the team level, but also at organizations much, much bigger than CARS. really just looking at a sliver of value, whether that's a team, whether it's a division, a company the size of cars, or, you know, companies that are much, much larger.
So before we wrap up here, I just wanted to see if there was any other insights or key learnings that's going to take us up to phase three that anybody from the CARS team would like to offer.
Yes. This is Clay. I will offer one very interesting thing. You are working bottoms up in this approach. The more up you go, the more stress that this is putting on the system. You're kind of slowly taking away decision making and pulling it down. You are also accelerating the speed at which things are getting done, which puts a level of discomfort, and the discomfort eventually rises up the org chart. That is a very important thing to manage. One of the ways we managed it was by trumpeting the successes as high as we could and letting that rain down on the org chart. And then as long as there were successes being trumpeted, the discomfort was being accepted. And then slowly kind of working that in and showing off and dragging, you know, organizational aspects through not only in the group that is flipping, but the outside group, really pulling those people in to watch what's going on, and then, you know, informing them of when things are going to happen, what is going to happen, and how we're going to do it.
Yeah, this is BJ. I want to say communication is a very important part to this, because, you know, as an organization, they're putting a lot of trust in the technology and product and user experience in this sort of aspect to reorganize under an agile methodology. But what you have to understand is that sales and all the other things involved in the company, you know, are still sort of organized in the same way. So it really puts a lot of onus on the product teams and the core delivery team to communicate outwards and to build trust in the product, because you have to recognize that senior manager in the organization has put trust in the product to reorganize like this, so you have to earn that trust.
Well, thank you very, very much. I'm gonna wrap here and give thanks to the CARS team for sharing their story and their insights and their learnings. And thanks go out to Mark. As one of the coaches, you had a lot to offer today, Mark. It was great to hear your voice and chiming in. And on behalf of Julian and myself and Thriving Org, thanks again. And we're looking forward to having you guys attend our call next week for the third in the series. Thanks again, and have a great day, everybody.